politics without the soap opera, with unfiltered constitutional conservative truth. The Conservative Review with Daniel Horowitz.
And welcome back, fellow American patriots and Minutemen standing at the ready to fight anew for the issues that matter in the way they matter at the time they matter here at Sierra Podcast. It is Wednesday, April 17th. Your host, Daniel Horowitz, back here today to actually focus on the issues that matter in the way they matter at the time they matter, because nobody else seems to be doing that. We seem to always inveigh against the system in the abstract, complain, gripe, bemoan, lament. And then when it actually comes to the specific legislation, the specific primaries, the specific leverage points that will affect the outcomes of whatever those grievances we may have, we're either silent, ignore it, or if we're aware of it, we support the very people that subvert ourselves. And what's been going on the last few weeks are really instructive to the message I've been trying to give over to you for so long. That A, the Republican Party is a fake opposition. The MAGA movement within the party, although some are well-intentioned, that has just become a controlled opposition on top of a controlled opposition, with Trump enabling directly and giving cover to Johnson and other rhinos that are up in primaries, so we can't exactly fix it. The fact that we've been focused on everything that we can't influence, the Dems, the media, but not on red state primaries, red state legislative sessions. I mean, all that stuff. Conservative voters have become nothing more than apathetic zombies. Really. I just sit back, just complain about the Dems, just pine for the outcome of November 5th as if it's a given somehow that Trump will win, as if it's a given that he does, it won't be negative effective or effective at all. And as if there's nothing we can do now to influence him to run a better campaign, a more focused, disciplined campaign, move to the right on the issues, talk about the things that people care about, wield his influence and pressure over Johnson, and focus again on these red state things. Instead, it's all the bros be flipping, we're going to win. If we don't, it's because the elections are stolen. And I'm here to tell you, I referenced this a little bit Monday, the biggest election fraud we have is the fake Republican Party and the fake enlightenment of the Republicans being fake, which is MAGA. That is the biggest election fraud. Let me say this. If you're in a red state, why is it that we're losing out? Meaning we're electing bad Republicans to the federal, you know, to Washington, House, Senate. We're electing bad Republicans as governor, to the legislature, county positions, and the policies are flowing from there. Is it because Klaus Schwab set up some sort of system to steal the election? No. You know, it's why when I prepare an agenda, and we're working on next year already, our top issues that we want to push in the legislatures, election fraud is not my number one issue. It's not anywhere close, because unfortunately, the states where it's the most problematic is where we really don't have much control. And the places where we do, you know, I'm all for tightening up. I supported my buddy Chuck Gray, Wyoming Secretary of State, and trying to do that. And the Rhino governor vetoed his new regulations. But the bottom line is, for the most part, you don't really have that problem. It's because we are a bunch of apathetic losers. The Republican primary voters are the problem, both in terms of sleeping through the primaries and then sleeping through the legislative sessions. And even when they're not in session, the counties are always in session. The governor is always in session. You could influence it. Okay? You live in Idaho, Missouri, South Carolina, Wyoming, just to mention a couple of states. These are your most important legislative primaries of the lifetime. Within the next 1 to 3 months, you will have voting. Some of these states have stupid early voting. Starts even earlier. I mean, you cannot imagine how much you can influence and organize in, you know, districts where, you know, you'll have legislative primaries where, I don't know, you have a total of 1,500 people voting in them. An enormous influence you could wield. And this is what you have to do. You have to do something different than what you're doing now because it's not working. Right now, we'll start off at the federal level. And then I want to get to the courts. Because there's so many layers to the failure theater that if we don't take our own destiny in our own hands and change the strategies, the landscapes, and the issues on which we focus, nothing will change. Because again, where it stands right now, it is unlikely Trump will win. It is very likely Dems will control the House. Don't shoot the messenger. You know, when last night Trump, rather than saying we need to focus on the border rather than Ukraine and saying Johnson better not support Ukraine, he's dead silent on the biggest intra-party fight, but he's tweeting about Jimmy Kimmel. I mean, like, what do you want from me? It's not my fault. So shut up, Daniel. This is the most important election of our lifetime. He's sure not acting like it. He's acting like vanity. It is... You know, most polls have Biden ahead now. And again, you know, this has been going on for a while already. Five elections in a row where Democrats have won. They continue to win most special elections. And it was just one aberration of you know, 6 weeks or so where Biden was lower in the polls, but only by a few points. When it came out, he was senile. And now that didn't even do it. Is it possible that it could go back again? Yeah. Could we have like a Comey moment that we had with Hillary a week before the election? Yeah. But are you going to count on that? I'm going to count on Trump winning. I'm going to count on that somehow is going to change things. I'm going to count on the fact that the Democrats won't respond in a way that will create crisis that Trump won't buy into. I'm going to count on the fact that Trump won't move to the left while saddling us with all the problems. And then the final issue is, and we're going to get to this soon, is whatever you're going to do, it's very clear now that we don't have the votes, right? There's a significant number of Republicans that are to the left of even party leadership. So you're never going to pass anything through Congress. It's going to have to be executive order. Well, every single thing you do as executive order is going to be downed by a random district judge. That they forum shop to a judge in California or Hawaii like they did in his first term. What is our plan to go through all those things? And that's why you have to wield the power where you have it. So let's start off federal. Then we'll go to some of the state stuff and obviously get to the courts. There's a very interesting opinion from Gorsuch, actually a good one, but unfortunately it was only joined as usual by Thomas and Alito that I want to get to that has bearings on what we need to be doing in the red states. But first, let's get back to the big fight of our time. We have never had a House leadership that was this perfidious, I'd say. It's not feckless. They're doing it on purpose. Where now any standalone Democrat proposition is viewed as a must-pass bill. I mean, Johnson, as we speak, is trying to get language to the floor for a foreign aid bill so they can vote for it on Saturday. I mean, you know, we always laugh at how Republicans take 2.5 weeks. The House is out for like 2.5 week periods at a time. And then even when they're in, it's like Tuesday night to Thursday morning type of deal. I mean, they never go over weekends. And they're treating this now the way they stupidly treat a government shutdown. Now, mind you, Republicans have so far declined to go along with the foreign aid supplemental for about a year. And then suddenly now, he's like, we gotta pass it before the end of the week. Like, what is up with that? Johnson gets up there and says, I'm a wartime speaker. I mean, this is what they think. He doesn't mean the war at our border. We now have 25,000 Chinese nationals caught just in the first few months in the few first months of the fiscal year. We have massive groups of Africans swarming New York City demanding green cards and visas because they were promised by their NGO traffickers that that's what they would get. That's not the war. The war team is Ukraine. It's unreal. Again, this is not a strategic problem. This is not a vote tally problem. Again, that would be if you want to pass a good bill. This is just don't bring bad stuff to the floor as a Republican speaker. And he's doing it anyway. It's a values problem. Yeah, Daniel, this is why we need Trump. Yeah, but Trump blessed it. Gave him cover. And he won't tweet about it. Again, the reason he won't is because he supports it. This is all with Trump support. Again, I don't understand how people could go 8 years into Trump's leadership of the party and he leads it with a greater degree of influence and control and image than anyone since Abraham Lincoln. And we're still like, ah, yeah, the DLP sucks. We need Trump. Like, dude, he made peace with it a long time ago. What do you want from me? I tried. I took a huge hit with my career to support a challenger against Trump. Some of you didn't listen. So now you get a bungling fool that is saddled with the legal problems. Every penny is going into that rather than a ground game. His focus is on bizarre nonsense rather than driving a message, rather than influencing the party that he controls right now. It is what it is. It's not my fault. I try to make the right play calls that will be beneficial both to us and to his potential of winning the election. But he does what he does. You're stupid to put your eggs in that basket. And these excuses he makes, oh, they're only going to be down to a 1 or 2 seat majority. I have news for you. Democrats only have a 1 seat majority in the Senate. And by the way, a 1 seat majority in the Senate is even more tenuous than in the House, because in the House, technically, you fully control it, whereas in the Senate, it's really 60 votes that you need. So when you only have 51, far short of that, you really don't control much. But they do. The reason they have control is because the Republicans agree with them. So let's not make pretend this is a numbers game. Let's be very real here. Republicans are not, there's no ability for them to win a 30-40 seat margin in the House. In the best case scenario, a scenario that's looking very unlikely, by the way, it would be like an 8-seat majority. That's still going to be very narrow in the sense that there are easily 30 House Republicans that are to the left of leadership. So let's get real. Let's stop living in the time. We don't have the votes. Oh, so vote more Republican. Okay. We need to think a little bit longer term than that. Again, what are you going to do about the uniparty problem? What are you going to do about Trump joining with it? What are you going to do about Trump having no logistical effort or messaging effort to win this election? And what are you going to do about the courts? That any good thing that we could rarely strive to achieve, we agree to this notion of struck down, that a court could veto, and not just the Supreme Court, but any randomly shopped district judge. So we're going to get into the judges. First, want to just tie up some things here with what's going on in the House. Our sponsor today is our friends at Birch Gold. One of our big action items for next year will be to facilitate the easement of state economies back into a gold standard, away from the entire economic tyranny that the Federal Reserve is foisting upon us. But right now, you can do that to an extent on your own by texting Daniel to 989898 today and getting your free info kit on investing in gold today from Birch. This is specifically to roll over your 401k or IRA into gold. You know, you don't have to do all of it. Do 30% of it so you diversify. Had you done it a year ago, you'd be up 17%. And let me tell you something. If history is any guide, there's almost no way you could lose out on that, given that they have lost control of the economy. They have lost control. Remember how they said they were going to lower interest rates? They said that they were going to lower interest rates four times this year. And now Powell basically admitted what we knew. They're not going to lower it a single time because inflation is just rip-roaring through the economy. And, you know, for obvious reasons, because the feds can't even sell off their treasuries because there's such a sheer volume. There's more supply than demand. So they have to keep raising the offer at the auctions. I mean, you're talking about a scenario where by the end of the year, the monthly annualized average of our interest on the debt will be $1.6 trillion. Remember, we're now at a point where about 30% of your tax dollars, if you would take the total national revenue of your tax dollars, about 30% of it goes to nothing but paying interest on debt. So anyway, right now is how, even without any legislation, you could at least, you know, again, to purchase everything in gold is, you know, we're working on ideas and how to use today's currency to do that, but certainly to roll over your IRA, 401k, text Daniel to 989898 now, and you'll be called by one of our friends at Birch Gold, brilliant economist today. Time to diversify and hedge against inflation with Birch Gold. So I just wanted to go over, you know, everyone keeps saying, oh, well, Daniel, this is not a reason to get rid of Johnson. This is not a reason. But you put it all together, this man has betrayed us beyond belief. Again, this is not a matter of the old days. The old days, the John Boehner days, was we have leverage, we should get X amount, and you squander it. And in worst case scenario, we get nothing for it. Johnson is now giving them more. This Congress is unique. Remember, this is 8 years into Trump's tenure. You might think, well, Trump's not president. Yes, he is. He's president of the Republican Party, meaning Trump influences the House GOP just as much as he would if he were president. You see, when he wants to call something in, he calls it in. He supported McCarthy, and that really is the original sin, by the way. People forget. That's really where we could have changed the trajectory. Remember back then they had a six-seat majority, slim, but not, you know, but, you know, it was functional. And Trump crushed our ability to close the deal on the original speaker's fight. McCarthy gave Biden more than he asked for on the debt ceiling. Okay? Not just 1 year, but 2 years, which was the rest of his term, free check. Johnson gave more than they asked on the NDAA, more than they asked on the budget, greater budget than any of Pelosi's budgets. And then on FISA, more than, it wasn't just a clean reauthorization. I want to double down on something we talked about last week with Warren Davidson. One of the amendments that Turner got passed, he's the chairman of the Intel Committee, was to expand it to Wi-Fi spots. And we talked about it very quickly, and I want to go through the consequences. Zero Hedge has a good summary of this. Under current law, the government can compel electronic communication service providers like Verizon and Google to have direct access to their communications, to assist the NSA to turn over the communications of those targeted, which, you know, what they say at a starting point is foreigners overseas, but, you know, 702 ropes in people here. So they, in this amendment changed the definition of electronic communication surveillance provider. So it's not just Google and Verizon. Any company or individual that provides any service whatsoever, meaning like even secondary, not the original, you know, like provider, but the one that's offering it, the company, may be forced to assist NSA. as long as they have access to equipment on which communications are transmitted, routers, servers, cell towers. So it could be a barber shop, it could be a laundromat, it could be a fitness center, it could be a hardware store, it could be a dentist office, it could be a corporate office, lawyers, nonprofits, financial advisors, healthcare providers, anywhere. Meaning Verizon might be the company that has the that owns the ultimate service, but the ones providing it to the individuals using it is the owner of that building or company. Right? I mean, this could be even tenants of landowners, landlords, house cleaners, plumbers, people performing repairs, IT servers. I mean, remember, a lot of these people who come to your home and they use the Wi-Fi, a lot of these people are foreigners. I mean, that's a whole other story, but all these jobs are going to have a lot of jobs monopolized by, look, frankly, probably illegals. I mean, we just had a new oven delivered. Our old oven broke, and this one will probably only last 5 years, as they all do. And the guys delivering it could barely speak English. I mean, I don't know what their story is, from some sort of Latin American country. So if you would access that, and who knows, if they're part of some sort of foreign issue, you're roped in. This is a massive expansion. None of these businesses would be allowed to tell anyone about the assistance that NSA would potentially compel them to provide. Sort of a gag order. Heavy penalties for those who don't comply. And unlike Google and Verizon, most of these businesses and individuals lack the ability to isolate and turn over a target's communication. Okay? You don't know that. So basically what you would do is just open up your equipment. You're just basically opening turning over everything you have to the NSA. Anything you've ever done, communicated with you, anyone else, and again, it's a daisy chain, goes on and on and on. Anyone else who worked with you at your business, even your home, a tenant, and anyone who came as a friend of a friend of a friend of a worker of a and on and on. This passed in broad daylight. Trump gave Johnson cover, said, "I told them vote the way you want." Everyone's like, yeah. I saw a friend of mine on Twitter. I used to go on her show. They defied Trump. Sorry, honey, but Trump said he told them to vote the way you want, then invited Johnson over to give him cover and say, this is the best he can do. Hey, we'll wait till I'm president. Of course, it's all about that. But then he makes it the most unlikely that he'll be elected president, and that if he is, he surrounds himself with the biggest idiots. What am I supposed to do? This is what Johnson just did to us. So again, if we had a sane movement, it would be hair on fire. Johnson needs to go. Listen to conservative media, and they're not happy with him, but notice it's not hair on fire. And the reason it's not hair on fire, you guessed it, because it's all about one freaking man. It's all about one man. And at the end of the day, they get the smoke signals from Mar-a-Lago, and the vibe they're getting is, he's our guy. Let's just talk about Jimmy Kimmel. Oh, whoops. Now we're on to funding Ukraine with Trump support. But Jimmy Kimmel. Look at Jimmy Kimmel. Look at this judge in Manhattan. And by the way, I'm sick of hearing about that bullcrap. Like I said last year, Trump is a greater presence than any district judge in a state judge in New York. DeSantis offered that he would never give him up. New York cannot go down to Florida and do anything. Oh, Daniel, but then he can't go to New York. They might arrest him. So what? New York's not a swing state. Okay? You don't need to campaign there. He could have had his lawyer there, give his case to the public. You can't have any state judge and state prosecutor in a blue state in a divided country just grab someone. I mean, that was his chance. Instead, he goes along with it. he also had a chance to force Johnson to put a defund rider on the, at least the federal prosecutions. Didn't do it. So again, either Trump is stupid and aloof to his own danger, or he knows something we don't know, that this is all failure theater. I don't know which one it is. Now, people need to be asking. Everything was but the polls. Well, the polling trend shows Biden is winning, including ones that showed Trump up, the Echelon poll, Morning Consult that previously had Trump up, now have Biden up. You also have Crystal Ball is moving the Arizona Senate race from toss-up to lean Democrat to Gallego over Carrie Lake. She's going to lose that race. And I'm sorry. So you could say it's voter fraud. You could say it's voter fraud. But what, the polls are picking up voter fraud? Voter fraud is when the polls show Republicans winning and we think they don't because of voter fraud. Now, really, it turns out it's a lack of ground game. And it also turns out, by the way, if you look at the RCP polling average, a lot of the 2022 like predictions were built off of Real Clear Politics website. And it look, they're pro-Republican. Now, it's fine, but just don't lie to yourselves. So when they said Republicans were going to win 240 seats, they had all these House seats, and they were off like 2-3 deviations. Like all the toss-up ones were a strong Dem. All the ones that there was an outside shot that Republicans could pick up, the Dem won by 100 points, you know, that type of thing. And they even lost some that were considered like total turnovers. A lot of this was built on RCP's own gaming it out. It turns out if you look at them now, they put in this Rasmussen poll that has Trump up 8, which everyone knows Rasmussen has become a joke and he's not up 8. And then they don't have in Morning Consult and the new Echelon polls. And in fact, someone has noted they have not updated their polling window for 10 days because it would put Biden officially in the lead. So a lot of the things go by the RCP average. The RCP average is not an average of all the polls. It's all the ones that they want to put in. So, like, I mean, I'm all for propaganda to, like, have fake polls to demoralize the other side. But let's not lie to ourselves like we did in 2022, where we had an RCP average full of Rasmussen and Trafalgar and POS, which is another Republican polling firm. I mean, you could do that, but it turned out to be bogus. So not everything is stolen. The GOP is the stolen election. Trump is the stolen election. Sure, it exists in the margins. But it's not the reason why Republicans are governing the way they do. Trump is taking the positions he's taking, and we're underutilizing the red state map both for state and federal elected offices with a bunch of fake Republicans. That's because of us. That's because of Republican voters are stupid. And we go along with this fake movement. So let's get real. Let's get real. Now, I want to get to one of the main things I want to talk about today is we have another problem here. And I've said that this is why I wrote my first book on stolen sovereignty on the courts. If we believe that any judge, much less the Supreme Court, but any judge could just, let's just talk about the federal courts for now, could just declare a law void, could veto it, could overturn it, could enjoin it fully, then we're done as a people. Because here's the thing. We've already established it's very difficult that Trump's going to get elected. It's very difficult. And if he does, he's not going to get anything past Congress. He's going to have to do everything executively. And every last thing immediately will be enjoined by the courts and, you know, will be done. And moreover, even if you follow my course of action, which is red state interposition, most things we want to do will immediately get chucked in the courts. I mean, even something as innocuous as, you know, not having boys and girls sports, right? a West Virginia federal judge, and now the Fourth Circuit upheld that injunction, you know, fully enjoined that law. And this is happening everywhere. So there's a very important concurrence, and this is something we need to fight for. And it ties into the lessons that I've been giving over to you about the courts the last couple weeks and couple months, that Republican judges are very much subject to influence. They don't go based on the technicalities of the law, that they go based on politics. And the more you have a kind of like, you know, get off our lawn vibe or give over that vibe to these judges, the more they feel the heat. You could tell they felt the heat after Dobbs that they're giving too much to Republicans. So then they moved over and started upholding a bunch of, you know, lower court injunctions on red state laws. And then, you know, there's been a lot of flack now. Well, now they went back the other way. And for the first time, finally, they did reverse an injunction of a lower court in Idaho. There's an Idaho case. Okay. What case is this? Let me just see here. Labrador v. Poe. Labrador is the Idaho Attorney General. Labrador v. Poe, if you want to look it up, where this was, you know, one of many states that passed a law banning chemical and physical castration. You know, there's like 20 different methods and drugs that they use, and the law banned it. And a district judge issued it a full injunction on it. And the Ninth Circuit, of course, agreed with them. And the state of Idaho appealed to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court did reverse it, at least pending the merits, reversed the injunction. And, you know, it's not clear what the vote was. It's clear that at a minimum we had five. It's not clear if Roberts agreed because Roberts didn't record, he didn't write any statement on it. So there's, as always, you know, it's either, we either have two good guys or we have three good guys. Gorsuch is number three. In this case, Gorsuch was good, but Kavanaugh and Barrett, they gave a very narrow thing in the weeds, why it was whatever. But Gorsuch wrote an important concurrence noting this. So there's been this whole debate that the Democrat judges like Jackson there, and this came up with the whole border stuff. You know, we have too many things on our emergency docket, too many things where everyone's trying to get the Supreme Court involved in these political issues and the cases we need to stop getting involved. And Gorsuch finally, you know, responded to it. I was like, wait a minute, you have it completely backwards. It's because at an unprecedented level, district judges are putting full in universal injunctions as if they have a veto power over every duly passed law in the legislature. So yeah, obviously the states are then appealing to us to deal with it. We need to revisit this entire notion of a universal injunction. And this might sound to some people in the weeds, but it's really not. It cuts to the core of what Article 3 judicial power actually is. Okay? So, at its core, I've said this before, whether it's federal or state, it kind of mirrors, the process is as a mirror image. You have a bicameral legislative body. A law passes one, and then it goes to another, and then it is signed by the president, or the executive, was a president or governor or county executive, and then it becomes law. There's no process that, oh, and then it goes to a court for review. Like the president could veto it, and then the Supreme Court or even a district court, appellate court could veto it. That's literally not how it works. The way it works is it is the law and it remains the law of the land and it always will be the law of the land until it's repealed through that same process. Now, what happens is courts interpret the law as it relates to individual parties. So, does the law apply to me or not? Okay, well, let's say it does. Okay? Let's say it does. In this case, you are a, I forgot what it was which direction it was. Boy wanted to, the parents of the this lunatic wanting to get some sort of chemical castration drug. Well, the law does apply in this case. It says you can't get that. So you don't have access to it. Well, what if I say that the law is unconstitutional? Okay, what if I say that? Now, even if you believe a court has a right to say that, they don't have exclusive sole final arbiter status. They have concurrent jurisdiction. For our purposes, look, you're coming in front of me as a judge. I believe it's unconstitutional. So I will say, John Doe, I will rule, I will grant relief, a form of relief to the plaintiff. Now, what relief is that? The relief is you could get access to that drug. Now, it's a lot more complicated when a judge wants to mandate a positive versus a negative. Because again, you know, a judge can do that if they believe it's unconstitutional. I believe in that. And there are times that we go to courts when we believe that we're being punished by something unconstitutional, and that's fine. But just know, if other branches of government disagree with that, they have the power and even responsibility to push back. So we say it all the time. Let's say, you know, a judge says, everyone from Somalia has the right to get a visa. Okay, you could say that, but, you know, who writes the visas? Not the judiciary. It's the executive branch. The executive branch knows that they have the proper interpretation of the law. They can say, we're not going to write it. And I believe that's what we need to go back to. But I'm not even getting onto that. I'm saying, even if you would say that they are compelled to listen and the state of Idaho is compelled to make available this drug or make sure that there's no penalties for it and punish people for using it or doctors for dispensing it, for prescribing it. But it doesn't strike down and enjoin the law. In other words, granting relief to a plaintiff is not the same thing as a universal injunction. A universal injunction means I enjoin the entire law, even for parties, people that are not parties to it, and for elements of the law that are not needed to grant them relief. In other words, in this case, so for example, my understanding is that other drugs, as well as the physical castration, is also put on injunction now, even though that was not subject to this lawsuit. Now, you could say that based on that ruling, other plaintiffs in other cases will come back and they'll apply precedent. And okay, but then you have to come back. But the point is, it doesn't have the power of immediately putting a law on ice. Courts don't have that power. Now, again, I would argue that the Supreme Court doesn't have that power either. It's no different. The only thing different about a lower court is there's two levels of universal injunction. There's one expanding it outside the parties. There's also expanding it outside the jurisdiction. So, for example, we talked about this a lot when Trump was president, this universal injunction, meaning on non-parties and non and other elements of the law that aren't party to the lawsuit. And then there's nationwide injunction. You apply it outside your jurisdiction. So the only place where, so both of those things need to end, that a district judge could extend power outside of the district and outside of the parties and the subject of that lawsuit. Now, the Supreme Court is only distinct in that they could do nationwide, or an appellate court is circuit-wide. But the same principle of, you know, they rule on IBM v. Microsoft, right? They don't rule on or they could say through the case that they think the law is unconstitutional, but it doesn't veto the law. And unless we get rid of this notion, this is going to continue. It's going to neuter a potential Republican presidency, and it's going to neuter any potential Freedom Caucus takeover of a state. So this is a very important concurrence by Gorsuch. I'm glad Thomas wrote this in the travel ban, Trump v. Hawaii, in 2017, 2018. And now it's good to see Gorsuch wrote it. Obviously, Thomas and Alito agreed. Barrett and Kavanaugh did not sign on to this. They just found some sort of narrow way. Yeah, we agree with Idaho here. But they don't want to go this far. So sadly, we don't have five yet, but we need to start building the pressure on Kavanaugh and Barrett. We need to dispense of this notion. And again, some of this is going to be a push-pull. Well, Daniel, the same way that courts don't have the right to strike down things, courts aren't the sole arbiter of their right to strike down. So I would argue we don't need to wait until Barrett and Kavanaugh agree. Governors need to start asserting this. So Gorsuch starts off, perhaps the court has seen a rise in the number of applications for interim relief. But if so, it seems to me that this trend is not the result of this court's precedents and traditional equitable standards. Instead, at least part of the problem may be attributable to a departure from those precedents and standards in lower courts. In recent years, certain district courts across the country have not contented themselves with issuing equitable orders that redress the injuries of the plaintiffs before them, but have sought instead to govern as entire state or even the whole nation from their courtrooms. Today, Idaho is on the receiving end of one of these universal injunctions, but lately it has often been the federal government. Okay, as best as I can tell, universal injunctions are a relatively new phenomenon. By some accounts, universal injunctions against the federal government during FDR's tenure were virtually unknown. In other words, he's being sarcastic. He said, you know, FDR's 12 uneventful years. And then he writes, Great Depression, New Deal, most of World War II. In other words, his point is FDR did a hell of a lot of things there. And yet, you know, the courts didn't, there was no like striking down. You know, even as late as President Obama's administration, some estimate that lower courts issued only about 19 universal injunctions against the government over 8 years. 19 in 8 years. Very interesting. By one count, he notes, so 19 in 8, under Trump, it was 55 in just 3 years. You know, COVID, you know, was the fourth year, so not much went on then. So a rising number of universal injunctions virtually guarantees that a rising number of high-profile cases will find their way to this court. Just consider this case. Idaho does not challenge the district court's injunction to the extent it addresses the plaintiff's asserted injuries. The state seeks relief here only because, and to the extent the district court prevented it from enforcing any aspect of its duly enacted law against anyone, all without any showing with other provisions in the statute that other provisions of the statute violate federal law or the rights of any current party. So this is a really, really important case. Today, the court takes a significant step toward addressing the problem. It does so not by reworking our precedents and traditional equitable practices, but by enforcing them. Lower courts would be wise. I'm skipping around here. Lower courts would be wise to take heed. Retiring the universal injunction may not be the answer to everything that ails us, but it will lead federal courts to become a little truer to historic limits of their office, promote more carefully reasoned judicial decisions attuned to the facts, parties, and claims at hand, allow for the gradual accretion of thoughtful precedent at the circuit level, and reduce the pressure on governments to seek interlocutory relief in this court. And you know, this is very important. So three judges signed on to that. Again, this is not, okay, these judges are good in this case, good in that case. This is everything. We need to move away from the notion that courts are a super veto. They're not. That's not technically what happens. And we sure didn't benefit from it with COVID, very little. You know, you would think there we would have appreciated, you know, full universal injunctions. Again, it's a one-way street for the most part. I'm not saying we've never benefited from it, nor should we try to play the game while it still is the prevailing practice in our political system, but it needs to end. It needs to end. Because the bottom line is the left has a much greater legal infrastructure than we do. They have the ability to take anything and put it in court immediately. So they can go to any of the 670 district judges in one of the 94 district courts to rule on any abstract public policy, fiscal, social, cultural, national security, border. And then immediately, they could. That is the law of the land. I often quote this. In the first debate between Lincoln and Douglas, this was in Ottawa, Illinois, August 21st, 1858. Lincoln mockingly points to Douglas, and he says, "This man sticks to a decision which forbids the people of a territory from excluding slavery. And he does so not because he says it's right in itself. He does not give any opinion on that, but because it has been decided by the court. And being decided by the court, he is, and you are bound to take it in your political action as law, not that he judges at all of its merits, but because the decision of the court is to him, thus says the Lord." And people were clapping, like it notes there was applause. He had this refrain, "thus says the Lord," making fun out of judicial supremacism. "He places it on the ground, on that ground alone. And you will bear in mind that thus committing himself unreservedly to this decision commits him to the next one just as firmly as to this. He did not commit himself on account of the merit or demerit of the decision, but it is a thus says the Lord. The next decision, as much as this, will be a thus says the Lord. There is nothing that can divert or turn him away from this decision." And that's the thing. I mean, let's say a court says everyone has to cut their balls off to make tranny people feel, you know, more welcome. Is that the law of the land? Courts don't do that. They grant relief to an individual plaintiff. And again, even then, when they are wrong, the other branches have an obligation to push back. That's a whole nother discussion we talk about all the time. That where it does intersect with politics. And it depends on the type of case. You know, some things are more within their jurisdiction. In other words, if it's a law that throws a person in prison, well, you know, convicting someone, that is much more the dominion of a court. It's harder for other branches of government to interpose against that. But then you have things like I gave you an example with, for example, you know, Trump wins the presidency, and he's like, you know, "We're not granting birth certificates to children of illegal aliens." Courts say, "No, you have to do it." Well, okay. I mean, you're asking for a positive benefit. Meaning there's a difference when a court rules you cannot lock this person up. You can't deny their liberty. You might have passed a law, but I don't like your law. I believe your law is unconstitutional. But then there's another case where they say, well, it's unconstitutional for you not to give them a positive benefit. Well, you don't control that. And we know you're wrong, so we're going to follow that. But for our discussion today about universal injunctions, this goes a step further. This is not within their dominion to even rule on that. They literally do not have that power. It's an unbelievable thing going on in our society today. It's an unbelievable thing. Thomas made this point in his concurrence in Trump v. Hawaii, that was the travel ban, you know, where finally after enjoining it for so long, we had a 5-4 ruling that, of course, a president has the power to exclude foreign nationals and whatever. So Thomas used that as an opportunity to go to town over these universal injunctions. And he already said it's becoming way too common, this practice. Quote, "These injunctions are beginning to take a toll on the federal court system, preventing legal questions from percolating through the federal courts, encouraging forum shopping, and making every case a national emergency for the courts and for the executive branch." And he noted that absent statutory authority from Congress, lower courts have no power to issue universal injunctions. This is the extent of power Congress holds over the lower courts. And in fact, Thomas actually wrote in a footnote there, if I remember correctly, that even if Congress granted them such authority, the Supreme Court would have to consider that might be unconstitutional because it violates the limits of Article 3 by conferring. In other words, Congress cannot, the same way Congress cannot delegate legislative authority to executive officials, right? This whole debate over the administrative state, that they could just determine broad discretion, so broad that it's as if they're writing their own laws. It's true of the judiciary as well. The lower courts don't want to acknowledge that they have any boundaries on the power. Allowing any single judge to just issue blanket policy prescriptions transforms their role from granting equitable relief in a legitimate case or controversy to a legislative and executive authority with the power to issue blanket mandates and vetoes on broad policies. Thomas concluded that concurrence, that, quote, universal injunctions are legally and historically dubious. If federal courts continue to issue them, this court is duty-bound to adjudicate their authority to do so. So this is good news that Gorsuch has now adopted Thomas's view. But again, I mean, we never really get more than three votes. And that's why it is going to be so, so vital. Remember, either way, we're going to have this problem. Because either Trump does win, and it's going to be a huge problem with nationwide injunctions. Nationwide and universal, meaning it applies outside the district, outside the parties, and outside the scope of what is needed to grant relief to those plaintiffs. Meaning often the plaintiffs that the judge is ruling in their favor, even if you agree with the ruling and agree with the power of the ruling, but they don't have in their toolbox, in other words, they don't write law. They're like, you know, guilty, innocent, right? Not guilty. That's what a court does. Do I have to pay this fine? No, you don't. Am I liable for criminal penalties in this situation? We believe you're not because we believe that part of the law is unconstitutional. But the verbalization of that, or the expression of that viewpoint that the law is unconstitutional, is not self-executing in and of itself and has a veto power over the law and rips it out of the book. Now, depending on what type of case and how much it intersects more with the judiciary than the executive branch and how much the other branches are willing or able to push back, it might sometimes eventually have a de facto effect of doing that, because then anyone who comes before them, they'll just issue a similar ruling. But it's not just instantaneously like a veto. I mean, this is such an obvious point, and it's literally one of the most basic things in our system of government that's being practiced erroneously. I mean, this is why I wrote my book on this in Stolen Sovereignty, because I was like, I can't think of anything more consequential after the left has built this edifice of this legal circus, that they have the ability, they control the law schools, they control the bar association, so they control the rules, the regulations. You're never going to beat them at their game. For every one that you could go get an injunction against bad blue state laws, they're going to have it 100 times against you. So we'd be stupid not to just get rid of this entirely. But again, getting back to my thesis, either if Trump wins, we're going to have this at the federal level, or if what I think that he's not going to win, then all the more so we're going to have an imperative to block the Fourth Reich in the red states. And, you know, I would argue, hopefully we succeed in some of these legislative primaries, expand the Freedom Caucuses. I think if Biden does win, there's going to be more of a frantic desire and ability for red states to get more aggressive. But remember, if we don't start pushing back and for governors and legislatures to start issuing their own opinions, you might think, well, the courts will laugh at it. Well, not really. I mean, depends on the type of judge. They are influenced by this to say, you do not have this power. So this concurrence from Gorsuch is one of the most important things we could fight for at this point. Because right now, see, the problem is right now, we have this problem that the left could form shop anything against us. For example, I forget the name of that dirtbag, Walker. There's this guy in Tallahassee, a federal judge in Tallahassee, that they get. I don't understand how he's assigned to every damn case of one of DeSantis's laws, and he goes after each one. Now, there, generally, they've been reversing it in the 11th Circuit, but most other circuits were losing, like the 9th and the 4th and the 3rd, 2nd, 1st, 10th as well. So then the Supreme Court is reluctant. This case, they swung back and ruled with us, but then for every one they do, it's kind of a scorecard. They don't want to. The best way is to get it out of their ability to begin with. So I've been rough on Gorsuch, but I think this case is good. But just another example of how Barrett and Kavanaugh are so bad. But again, broadly getting back to what we started with at the beginning of the show, we need people with foresight, not just reacting to what's in front of them, not just sitting apathetically as a zombie, just sit back, it will all be good. No, these are things we have to work out. It's not going to work itself out. You're not going to win elections on your own. You're not going to win governing on your own just by pressing a button and being apathetic the rest of the time. We need innovative ideas. And again, you'd be surprised. Like, I'm not going to take credit, but I mean, you know, whatever. I mean, there have been things that I have written that have percolated their way into certain circuit court judge opinions and even some of Thomas's opinions. You know, they read. They're human beings, okay? They're not like someone behind a wall. They're really just as amenable to pressure as elected Republicans are. And that's why, you know, the body politic, everyone, influencers, but certainly the governors and legislatures, they need to start saying, wait a minute, you do not have this power. You do not have this power. It's not that Kavanaugh and Barrett rule, you know, said explicitly they don't agree with it. They just didn't sign on to this concurrence and found their own Weasley way of dealing with this. But we need to ratchet up that pressure, because otherwise, I'm telling you, we're going to be left like a drunkard November 6th, no matter what happens, with a lot of big problems on our hands and no solutions. So we don't have time for this nonsense. That's why I need you guys to elevate this show over all of the junk food equivalent of podcasts. Give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. Send me an email, DanielHurwitz@startmail.com. Till tomorrow, God bless y'all, and thank you for listening.